Welcome to History Counts. History provides the roadmap to the future. If you want to know where you're going, you have to understand where you've been. I'm your host, Ken McDermott Rowe. The life of civil rights leader and peace advocate Martin Luther King was ended at the age of 39 by an assassin's bullet. Months after the murder, the authorities proclaimed that the crime had been solved. The murderer, they said, was a lone gunman with unclear motives, who acted on his own behalf and no one else's. It was a familiar story, but is it true? Today on History Counts, we take a look at the assassination of Martin Luther King. Who really killed Dr. King and why? Stay tuned to History Counts. Welcome to History Counts. I'm your host, Ken McDermott Rowe. Our subject today is the assassination of Martin Luther King, and our guest is author and international lawyer William Pepper. Mr. Pepper, who is both a British barrister and an American lawyer, investigated the murder of Dr. King for over a quarter century. For several years, he represented Dr. King's supposed assassin, James Ray, in Ray's legal efforts to obtain a trial. Mr. Pepper later represented the family of Dr. King in a civil wrongful death action against those believed to be responsible for Dr. King's murder. Mr. Pepper is the author of An Active State, The Execution of Martin Luther King. Thanks very much for being with us, Mr. Pepper.
No, you're welcome.
Can you tell us when and where Martin Luther King was murdered?
Martin Luther King was assassinated in Memphis, Tennessee on the 4th of April, 1968 at approximately 1 minute past six.
And why was he in Memphis, Tennessee?
He was in Memphis, Tennessee, and to organize a march on behalf of the striking garbage workers. They had been on strike for a period of months, and it had polarized the Memphis community. Dr. King led a march on the 28th of March, which broke up into turbulence and violence, and he had to be rushed from the scene. Later, we learned that that march was broken up by provocateurs who came from outside of Memphis, particularly from Chicago and St. Louis.
Now, while many Americans think of Martin Luther King principally as a civil rights leader, in the year before his death, he started to move into other areas. Can you talk about that?
Well, I only knew Martin King the last year of his life, and I came to know him when I came back from Vietnam. I'd been a journalist in Vietnam, and when I came back, I wrote one piece in particular that caught his attention. It had to do with for Ramparts magazine, and it had to do with the effect of the war on the civilian population of Vietnam, most of whom were either under 15 years of age or elderly, and they were, of course, being slaughtered. And that struck some of my photographs struck him, and so he asked to meet with me, and I worked with him then the last year of his life, and began pretty conclusively to turn him and see him turn into more than a civil rights leader, and that had been the direction he'd been heading in anyway, but he now became a committed human rights advocate and an anti-war campaigner.
He made a famous speech at Riverside Church just a year before the assassination.
Yeah, 1 year to the day, April.
In which he declared his opposition to the war. He was also involved in a poor people's campaign that was going to have a demonstration in Washington that summer.
Yes, he was leaving Memphis, actually, to head into Mississippi and begin the mobilization of marchers into Washington, not for the purpose of holding a demonstration and marching, but for the purpose of living in an encampment inside Washington, the shadow of the Washington Memorial. So he was going to bring many, many thousands of people there for the purpose of taking up residence in the nation's capital and going up and visiting their Congress people on a daily basis in an effort to try to press them to put back into the budget funds that had been taken out were needed for social programs, but had been denied because of the war.
And there was also some talk that he might run for president in 68?
Yes, there was a very distinct movement, and that's really what became a major part of my activity. He asked me to head up a National Conference for New Politics, which was an umbrella organization of all the anti-war and peace activist movements throughout the country, including disenchanted Democrats, members of the Democratic Party, who wanted to see this war end. And the idea was to form a ticket of Martin King and Dr. Benjamin Spock as a third party alternative and on an anti-war platform.
You note that in 1979, the House Select Committee on Assassinations found that the FBI had targeted Martin Luther King since the early 60s. Why was the FBI after Dr. King?
Well, I mean, Hoover took a strong personal dislike to Dr. King, and of course, Hoover was looking for every opportunity he could to tie the civil rights movement and Martin King to communist influence in the Communist Party. This, of course, was an effort to divert, and successfully did for many years, divert attention away from Hoover's alliance with organized crime and his working relationship effectively with organized crime in the United States by being able to deny its existence, which he did for many, many years. So he targeted King and
these activities,
other civil rights leaders.
These activities included things like burglaries and wiretaps and infiltration.
Yes,
the whole
Quantelpro operation.
You mentioned that they even had an informant in his executive staff.
Yes, they had an informant who was handled by an agent out of the Atlanta field office, and would.
Now, subsequent to the shooting of Dr. King on April 4th, who was arrested for the murder?
Well, James Earl Ray was arrested at Heathrow Airport in London. And charged with the assassination. He had been well and duly set up, although none of us realized it at the time, and indeed I didn't realize it for 9 years. It took me 9 years. 9 years later, when Abernathy asked me to go interrogate Ray, that we began to really look at the serious possibility that the man was innocent.
How did he supposedly do the crime? Where was he shooting from?
Well, supposedly he committed the crime from a bathroom window, a rooming house that backed onto Mulberry Street and the Lorraine Motel. And supposedly, allegedly, he had rented the room and he just waited for Dr. King to appear, and then he shot him and fled down the stairway and out the front door, where he went a few feet south on Main Street, dropped the bundle in the doorway of an amusement parlor and record shop, and then got into a Mustang, drove away. Now that was the story that of the actual killing that the government put forth.
And he did plead guilty subsequently.
He was coerced by his second lawyer, Percy Forman, who had promised him a trial, but at the end of the last minute, coerced him into pleading, into copping a plea, saying they were going to fry him. The media had already convicted him, that his family would be harassed forever. But the main reason James told me that he finally decided just the plea was Forman said, look, my health is not good, and I can't give you your best defense. So just take this plea and then hire another lawyer, set it aside, and you'll be much better off.
Did Ray recant his plea?
Oh, sure. always, I mean, he never actually said that he did it. He accepted legal responsibility in a series of check stipulations. And James had 3 days after, 3 days after the sentencing hearing, he moved to set aside his guilty plea and to seek a trial.
Although the government claimed that Ray had committed the murder by shooting from a bathroom in a rooming house, several witnesses, you point out, appeared to have seen gunfire coming from a bushy area instead.
That's right. The area behind the rooming house, which is now, by the way, a museum, but the area behind that rooming house was overgrown with bushes and brush and massive amount of undergrowth there, and that's where the sniper actually lay in wait. And yes, he was seen by a number of people who independently reported seeing.
In addition, during the course of your representation, a judge ruled that the gun, the rifle that he allegedly used, had not been sighted.
Yeah, it had not been sighted in, and it was off both to the left and too low, so it could not have been used in that murder. And in addition to that, of course, the state could not match any test fires from that rifle to the death slug.
Now, the rooming house was above a grill owned by a man named Lloyd Jowers, and in 1993, Mr. Jowers made a request for immunity to the Tennessee Attorney General. Can you talk about what he admitted to doing?
Yeah, Jowers initially just started off by admitting that he had been involved in a conspiracy, in the conspiracy to kill Dr. King, and he asked for immunity. He wasn't a good citizen. I mean, it's not something he did voluntarily out of the goodness of his heart. We had a number of witnesses, independent witnesses, who tied Lloyd Jowers to this killing. So he thought this was a bit up. He didn't know that he was going to not be indicted, and so he thought he'd asked his lawyer to get immunity for him.
And what was his involvement with respect to the rifle, with respect to the funds that may have been used for the assassination?
Well, Jowers received $100,000 in a delivery box, in a vegetable delivery box, which was routed to him by Frank Liberto, who was a lieutenant in the Carlos Marcello organization. And he received that money in his grill, called Jim's Grill. His role was to accept and hold on to the murder weapon for a brief period of time, and then it was to basically be out in the back Bush's area, and to take the weapon from the shooter, which he did. And as he burst into the back of the kitchen with a still smoking rifle, there was Betty Spates, who had been his mistress for a number of years, who had come looking for him, and she saw him rush by her holding this gun, break it down, and wrap it into a towel. But she heard that only moments after she had heard the rifle shot. She was standing inside the kitchen. She heard the rifle shot.
Now, he also made admissions to Dexter King and Andrew Young, not just about the money and the rifle, but about planning sessions that occurred in Jim's Grill involving Memphis Police Department personnel. Can you talk about that?
There were planning sessions in the grill. It involved a number of police officers in the Memphis Police Department, and Jowers admitted that they took place. So he was fully involved in this operation.
The Memphis Police Department failed to undertake certain security measures you mentioned when Dr. King came to Memphis on April 4th, including depriving him of his usual security guard of black detectives.
Yes, there was usually a group of detectives, four black detectives who had always watched out for Dr. King when he came to Memphis. And in this instance, they were not formed.
You also mentioned that the emergency tactical police units were pulled back from the Lorraine Motel, and that, curiously, two black firemen assigned to a firehouse overlooking the Lorraine were told not to report.
Yeah, there were the TAC-10 unit that had been stationed at the Lorraine was pulled back to the fire station, to the firehouse, which is on the corner of Mulberry and stretches up to South Main Street. They were pulled back there out of the area, the immediate area. A black firemen were instructed not to show up that day. They were removed from duty. That's right.
And it's not clear why Dr. King was assigned a room with a balcony.
His room was supposed to be down below in an alcove area. And they switched his room virtually at the last minute and put him up in room 306, which was the balcony room overlooking the swimming pool, which, of course, was not in use. But he was in an ideally exposed position for the assassination.
Now, who was Frank Liberto, the man who gave Jowers the $100,000?
Frank Liberto, who made the arranged the funds, did not himself give them to him. He had them by a delivery person. Frank Liberto ran a food wholesale warehouse outside of downtown Memphis, and he was Marcello's man in Memphis. Very close connections with the police department because they were very much involved in illegal gambling and prostitution and drug running, the usual mob activities, and they needed protection, which they got. And Liberto was the guy who was assigned to carry out a lot of the work on the ground in terms of organizing the assassination.
Now, a man named John McFerrin gave evidence about a phone call that he heard just before the assassination, to be on April 4th, around 4:45 or 5 o'clock. Can you talk about what Mr. McFerrin says he heard?
He owned a small grocery store and a gas station up in Somerville, about an hour from Memphis. And he would shop once a week at Liberto's warehouse and pick up his wholesale products. And he was in there on the day of the assassination, on April 4th in the afternoon, about an hour and a half before the killing. And at one point when he was in the store, he heard Liberto on the telephone screaming into the telephone, shoot the son of a bitch when he comes out on the balcony, and don't bring your ass around here, go down to New Orleans and get the rest of your money from my brother.
Tell me about a man named Raul and what involvement he had.
Raul was James's handler. James had always said that he had a handler, and his name was Raul. And he'd been treated as some sort of fanciful figure, but we've pretty much established who he was, and the fact is that he did handle. He was James's handler. He did meet him in a bar up in Montreal as James was trying to leave the country. Remember, James was an escaped convict, and he was on the run trying to leave the country. And this guy, there's certain people have been helping him and steering him toward the Canadian docks in Montreal, and he was in this bar, and that's where this fellow Raul effectively picked him up, made contact with him, offered him a job, offered to buy him a car, and wanted to keep him on a string for making certain deliveries for him and running errands, at the end of which he promised him he would get travel documents for him.
Did Raul have anything to do with getting a rifle to the grill?
Yeah, I mean, Raul, of course, designated the rifle that James was to buy, and when James bought the wrong rifle, Raul sent him back. This was in Birmingham to buy a .30-06, which he didn't buy the first time. So, and then Raul met him the night before the killing. He met him at the New Rebel Motel just outside of Memphis and took the rifle away from James. That was the last James saw the rifle. That rifle was the throwdown gun that was found in Knipe's doorway.
I see, and another gun was actually used for the assassination.
Oh, yes. No, yeah, that was just the throwdown gun.
Now, Raul connects to Carlos Marcello through a gun-running operation that also connects the U.S. military. Could you talk about that?
Yeah, that was an interesting, almost convoluted connection. Around this time, there were a number of military bases and forts and that were being looted of weapons, of armaments. And they were being often driven into Marcello's place on the water and put on a flatboat, shipped around into Houston, unloaded in Houston, repackaged by a team there. And Raul was part of that team, repackaged by a team there. In fact, this Raul led the team. And then they were being sold into Latin and South America. Two of the people who drove the grunts, soldiers who drove the truck with weapons in, were a part of the sniper unit that was really coincidental. The sniper unit that was in Memphis as a backup unit.
Well, now could you talk about the 902nd Military Intelligence Group and in general the U.S. military domestic spy operations that they were involved in the years preceding the assassination?
Well, I think the military has been far more active and involved in domestic espionage and surveillance on American citizens than has ever been revealed. When Ramsey Clark would not sign sign an authorization for wiretapping on Dr. King and his residence and his church and so forth, Hoover then went to his buddies in military intelligence under Bill Yarborough, with the Assistant Chief of Staff for Intelligence, and they had the military involved in the surveillance of Dr. King. So it was a very extensive operation. The Deuce was right in the middle of all of it.
You mentioned that the 902nd was deployed in small units throughout 67 and 68, and that they carried mug books of black leaders.
Yeah, that's what I was told, that they had small units, often sniper units, and they carried mug books of community leaders who were deemed hostile and to be neutralized in one way or another.
Now some of your information about the 902nd and the military involvement of the events of April the 4th comes from a man named Warren?
Those are pseudonyms. Warren and Murphy are pseudonyms. To protect. I try to protect people who are still alive and certainly people who tried to provide us with information and help us. They're out of the country, but and they provided information. They were members of the sniper unit. They provided information through Steve Tompkins, who the same journalist who became aware of their presence in Memphis.
Now, you say that Warren was a member of something called Alpha 184 Team. Can you talk about the activities of the team on April 4th?
It was an eight-man sniper unit that left Camp Shelby, Mississippi, and drove, left at about 5:30 in the morning and drove into Memphis. And various members of the unit took up their appointed positions. And their task was, so they thought, was to take out Andrew Young and Martin King. And Andrew Young was a bit of a surprise, but they had two sniper units, two sniper teams, and one of them, the one on top of the railroad building, was to take out Andrew Young. And that, they thought, was their job. And they were in position and ready to go. And then what happened was the sniper, it was a civilian sniper, and they were the backup, in my view, to that civilian sniper. The civilian sniper fired from the bushes and accomplished the task, and so they were not needed. They were told to disengage and withdraw.
Now the King family in 97 came to support James Ray's legal maneuverings for a trial. What was the result of that?
Well, there were two trials, and one can say, connected with this whole thing. One back in 93, which related to evidence that we had at the time and it was actually a television trial, but it was unscripted, and it was bitterly fought with an independent jury and a former federal judge presiding. And that took that, with the minimum of evidence we had at that time, it took that jury 7.5 hours to find James not guilty, which was a shock to Hickman Ewing. In particular, it was the prosecutor, and had former U.S. attorney in Memphis and former, later to be a Ken Starr prosecutor against Bill Clinton. So that was one then, and that, by the way, opened the floodgates to a lot of information that we didn't have. Okay, the second trial, the one to which you're referring, was the civil trial, which was an actual civil trial.
So you chose a civil route then?
It was the civil route whereby the King family would sue Lloyd Jowers and others, including agents of the United States and agents of the state of Tennessee and city of Memphis, for conspiracy to kill Martin King. Jowers was the key defendant in that trial.
Did they seek damages, monetary?
No, they only thought, well, they did, but only to the extent that it was required to pay the burial cost.
And that trial,
the equivalent of the burial cost.
And that trial took place in 1999 in Memphis?
Yeah, it took place in 1999 in Memphis, and it lasted for 30 days. Had 70 witnesses. Probably never before in history has an assassination been so well documented and detailed under oath.
And what was the jury's verdict?
The jury found for the King family that a conspiracy existed, and took them 59 minutes. And they only attributed 30% of the responsibility to Lloyd Jowers, and the rest they attributed to the government.
So they determined that Lloyd Jowers participated in the conspiracy, but that others, including government agencies, also participated.
Yes, absolutely.
And what was the media's reaction to the verdict?
Silence. The media's reaction to most things has been silence. There was one article in the New York Times, and then it went away. The media stayed in the hallway through most of the trial, not hearing the evidence. When Mrs. King testified, or Andrew Young, or Dexter, they came in, took note of that testimony. But when the real hard evidence was being presented, they were, for the most part, not capable, not willing to report it. So the American people, most American people don't even know the trial took place.
Well, thanks very much for being with us, Mr. Pepper. You're listening to History Counts, and we've been talking about the assassination of Martin Luther King with attorney William Pepper, author of An Act of State, The Execution of Martin Luther King. This is Ken McDermott Rowe, host of History Counts. One should not underestimate the effect that political assassinations have had on the course of history. If Martin Luther King had lived, how might have American history changed? Would race relations have evolved toward integration rather than black power? Would blacks and whites have made common cause in the labor movement? Would the Vietnam War have continued for another 7 years? Thank you for joining us. History Counts is produced by MDR Productions, Inc., and engineered by David Schwartz. Please visit us at historycounts.org, where you can listen for free to an archive of this program and others. Until next time, this is Ken McDermott Rowe for History Counts.